DM is a 100 years old. It's a mission that has about 160 missionaries working around Europe, mainly in church planting, but not only in that, from many, many parts of the world, but working very much in a concentrated way in the continent of Europe. Today, I combine a leadership responsibility, international leadership responsibility within ECM, with teaching the master's modules in European mission at Redcliffe College. So it goes without saying that I'm passionate about mission in Europe. So just out of curiosity, I wonder if are there any Europeans here this morning? Yeah, I sort of expected that sort of reaction. This year sees the centenary of the start. Okay, this is where you find out. There we go. By the start of the First World War, when many of our grandparents and great-grandparents lost their lives, or was it the case of my paternal grandfather lost his leg. When he left home for the European front, he was just 18. In a few months, Alex, Sam, John, and a few others will go off to university. Their great-grandfathers, at the same age, were going off to war. As you'll know, last Friday was the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings in Normandy, the decisive moment in the Second World War when another generation of British men made their way across the Channel to fight for peace in Europe. Have any of us here had to pick up a gun, learn how to use a gun to defend our homeland? Put your hands up if you've had to do that. Just a handful. The vast majority of us have never had to do that. That is an extraordinary historical anomaly. For most of Europe's history, we have been at war, and in every generation, there has been a conflict that has seen the young men go off to war. The peace that we've enjoyed for the last 70 years was bought at a very heavy price. And many of the European institutions that the British press so enjoy poking fun at have contributed very significantly to maintaining that peace in Europe. Today I'm going to be preaching about mission in Europe, but the first thing I have to do is to challenge the prejudice that so many of us Britons have about Europe. We recently had elections to the European Parliament. In fact, two Sundays ago coincided with the election in a very significant proportion of the 28 states of Europe. And yet there was not a single mention of it in the service here, nor did we pray for our members of the European Parliament. Less than one in three of us even bothered to vote. It's no accident that UKIP were so successful in those elections. They've managed to tap into this anti-European reflex that, like the Monty Python sketch, seems to have us all asking, what have the Europeans ever done for us? Well, I'm sorry to inform you, but, sorry, I've gone forwards there, but I didn't mean to. There you go. So I have to click back. How do you click back? Oh, dear. Can you do that from down there? Just left cursor, maybe left cursor, maybe? Arrow left. No, never mind. Just ignore that for a minute, okay? Well, I'm sorry to inform you, but the UK is a European country. And this statement has nothing to do with politics. You simply cannot tell the history of Britain without telling the history of Europe. Sociologically, the UK is European. You are Europeans. Just ask an African or an Asian whether you're a European or not. They won't have any doubt about it. We might deny it, but we are Europeans. Now, that's a wonderful way to ingratiate yourself to a British church congregation on a Sunday morning. I can just hear the whirring in your minds going round and round. What an odd way to start a sermon on mission in Europe. But the truth is that that Euroscepticism has found its way into the church. It has made us blind to the gospel realities on our doorstep. It has made us deaf to the call of Europeans to come over and help us. So today, we're going to remind ourselves of the moment when the gospel first came to us, to Europeans. Acts chapter 16, verses 1 to 15. Acts 16. He, Paul, came to Derbe and then to Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived, whose mother was a Jewess and a believer, but whose father was a Greek. The brothers at Lystra and Iconium spoke well of him. Paul wanted to take him along on the journey, so he circumcised him because of the Jews who lived in that area, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. As they travelled from town to town, they delivered the decisions reached by the apostles and elders in Jerusalem for the people to obey. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and grew daily in numbers. Paul and his companions travelled throughout the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been kept by the Holy Spirit from preaching the word in the province of Asia. When they came to the border of Mysia, they tried to enter Bithynia, but the Spirit of Jesus would not allow them to. So they passed by Mysia and went down to Troas. During the night, Paul had a vision of a man of Macedonia standing and begging him, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." After Paul had seen the vision, we got ready at once to leave for Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. From Troas, we put out to sea and sailed straight for Samothrace, and the next day on to Neapolis. From there, we travelled to Philippi, a Roman colony and the leading city of that district of Macedonia, and we stayed there several days. On the Sabbath, we went outside the city gate to the river, where we expected to find a place of prayer. We sat down and began to speak to the women who'd gathered there. One of those listening was a woman named Lydia, a dealer in purple cloth from the city of Thyatira, who was a worshipper of God. The Lord opened her heart to respond to Paul's message. When she and the members of her household were baptized, she invited us to her home. "If you consider me a believer in the Lord," she said, "come and stay at my house." And she persuaded us. So we need to remind ourselves of the context here. The Apostle Paul made three missionary journeys, according to the book of Acts. And in the first of those, he visited what we know as Turkey, what was then called Asia Minor, that part that's sticking out from the right-hand side across towards the west. He took with him Barnabas and a young man called John Mark, who was Barnabas's cousin. At the end of chapter 15, though, we find that they are discussing the possibility of returning to those churches to visit them again, and a huge row erupted between Paul and Barnabas. The argument was about whether John Mark should be allowed to go along with them again, because on the first journey, John Mark had turned back. He had gone back to his hometown because he was fearful of the opposition that they were suffering. Barnabas wanted to give John Mark a second chance. Paul said, "No way, he's shown himself unfit for the task, and I'm not taking him again." And so they argued, and they eventually decided to go their separate ways. Barnabas went with John Mark, and he went across to Cyprus, which you can just see down in the bottom right corner of that map. And Paul took a new companion and by the name of Silas, and headed off to the northwest, going back across those towns that you can see there in Anatolia, in Asia Minor. When they came to the town of Lystra, they were joined by a young man called Timothy, and the three of them set off westwards, apparently intending to head for Ephesus. Now, I had the privilege of going to Ephesus I had the chance to go to Ephesus just a couple of weeks ago. And it's just an amazing place to visit. You can still almost imagine yourself there into the city, the incredible paved roads through the ruins, and the amazing amphitheater that would have had a bigger population, more people could get into the amphitheater in Ephesus than into King's Home. Okay, so it was a big place, and that was where Paul preached and suffered a certain amount of persecution as well. And you can see there the road heading down to the coast. That would have been the coast at the bottom of that paved road. And the reason why Ephesus ended up in ruins was simply that the river silted up and it couldn't be used as a port anymore, and so it was abandoned. Rome, the plan almost certainly would have been to head for Ephesus. But as Woody Allen once said, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Thomas Aquinas used to say, man proposes, but God disposes. And of course, in the book of Proverbs, we have its own version there. In a heart, a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. Paul had his strategy, but the chief strategist of mission is God himself. Now, we don't know how, but the Holy Spirit kept them from preaching the gospel in the province of Asia as they planned. And so Paul turned north, up through Galatia, as you can see there on the map. Then he bore west into Phrygia. Now, these were not heavily populated areas. Frankly, it would have appeared that they didn't know where they were going, because they were in the middle of nowhere. And as they approached Mysia in northern Turkey, they concluded, well, maybe God wants us to head towards the north coast, to Bithynia, to some of the larger population centres there. No, wrong again. Spirit of Jesus impeded them. They couldn't go south into Asia or north into Bithynia. To go east would basically mean going home. And so they only could go one way, which was west, down to the coast, to the city of Troas. Now, it's a minor point, but it's worth noting this in the text, that from this point onwards, there's a subtle grammatical change. Up until verse 8, the author has spoken of they. But from here on, he talks about we. And the most likely explanation is that from Troas onwards, Luke, the author of the gospel, of the book of Acts, joined the missionary team. So now there are four of them: Paul, Silas, Timothy, and Luke. And there in Troas, on the banks of the Bosphorus, that body of water that separates the Black Sea from the Mediterranean, from the Aegean Sea, there Paul had a vision. The vision was of a man from Macedonia in northern Greece, the other side of that strait of water. The vision of a man crying out, come over and help us. So who was this man of Macedonia? Well, we don't know, frankly. We have no idea. But it is worth remembering that today, on Pentecost Sunday, that God had brought Jews and God-fearers from across the Roman world on that first Pentecost day to be witnesses to the extraordinary events of that day, when the Spirit of God would come down on the Church of Jerusalem. We read in the verses following those that Christine read to us earlier, Parthians, Medes and Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. Maybe, just maybe, Paul's vision came as a response to the prayers of one of those Europeans that was there that day and that returned home to Greece and was crying out to God in prayer, send us someone to help us. Now, I'm speculating, of course, but what is not speculation is that the vision of the man of Macedonia marked a decisive turn in Paul's ministry and arguably in the history of Christian mission. Because despite devastating persecution, in just three centuries, Christianity became the religion of the whole of Europe, at least the Europe that was known at that time. and it became the uniting feature that gave Europe its identity. We might say that Christianity became the European religion, but we might just as easily say that Europe became the Christian continent. And of course, it was missionaries from Europe that centuries later took the gospel to the ends of the earth. Europe today, though, is quite different. We're going to have to do something with this if I do a... Okay. Europe today. More than 500 million people just in the 28 states of the EU. If you add in those that are in the Council of Europe, the countries that consider themselves Europeans, even if they're not in the political structure of the European Union, we're talking about more than 800 million people. Only a quarter, though, of the world's Christians live in Europe today. That's including all of the Christian denominations. We face tremendous challenges from secularism, but also from Islam. The public sphere in Europe today, the politics, the media, education, are secular spaces where anyone who is a committed believer is seen as intellectually inferior. And alongside Christianity, Islam too is ever more confident. Colin Edwards and I yesterday attended an event at Sir Thomas Ritchie's school, which was in effect an Islamic gospel presentation in some ways, where a man gave an extended testimony of how he had converted from Catholicism to Islam, right there in our neighbourhood. Evangelicals constitute less than 2.5% of the population of Europe, perhaps around 18 million. And there are 20 European countries where the percentage of evangelical Christians is less than 1%. Today, God has taken the initiative in this by bringing millions of migrants to Europe from many other parts of the world where Christianity is much more vibrant. And we give thanks to God for that, what's called reverse mission. Paul's vision was of a man crying for help. Many of those who've come from the global south have done so with a sense in their hearts of responding to that Macedonian call from the European church saying, come over and help us. Europe today is perhaps more similar to the state it was in the time of Paul than it has been since that time. Let's go back, though, to chapter 16 of Acts. In verses 11 to 15, we find Paul and his companions arriving in the port of Neapolis, and they make their way up the paved road to the principal city of Philippi. They find that there's no synagogue there, and so they make their way down to the river, to the place of prayer. Paul's vision had been of a man of Macedonia, but the first to respond to their message was actually a woman, a God-fearing Gentile businesswoman by the name of Lydia. Now, Lydia was a sort of first century Stella McCartney or Victoria Beckham. She was a dealer in purple cloth, which only the super rich could afford. She and all her household were baptized, and she opened her home to Paul and his companions. And the rest of chapter 16 is a sort of whirlwind of events involving an exorcism, a near lynching, imprisonment, and an earthquake. You can read that at home. But after it all, they come back to Lydia's house. We read in verse 40, after Paul and Silas came out of the prison, they went to Lydia's house where they met with the brothers and encouraged them. Then they left. And so the first church in Europe was planted in the house of Lydia. Now, I don't know what the church in Lydia's house looked like, but I know it didn't look anything like any church building that we've ever seen. In fact, it wasn't until after the Edict of Milan in 313 AD that the persecution of Christians finally ceased and they could begin to meet in public buildings. And up to that point, they met in homes. It's worth remembering that many of those that are thought of as the church fathers, Polycarp, Irenaeus, Clement, Origen, would have never known anything other than a church meeting in a home. That was the only church that they'd ever experienced during their lives. So how can we apply all this to us as Christian witnesses in Europe today? Well, first of all, I think we need to think about Lydia. Lydia is a great example of what Jesus called a person of peace. In Luke chapter 10, when he sent out the 72, he instructed them to be on the lookout for people who received them into their homes with peace. Now, there are lots of other examples of this. Peter and Cornelius, Philip and the eunuch, Paul and Lydia. And in each occasion, the person is receptive to the message. And through them, many others come to faith. Many people rejected Paul's message. In fact, most people rejected Paul's message. But through the ones and twos that were receptive, the church was established. It is no different today. We shouldn't expect that everybody receives the gospel joyfully. Most will not. But if we do not share the gospel because we fear that some will reject it, we may miss out on finding those people of peace that God has placed in our workplaces, in our families, in our friendship networks. Secondly, it's worth observing too the power of hospitality, both that which is given and that which is received. Who gave the hospitality here? Lydia. It wasn't Paul being Paul as the mature Christian being generous with his hospitality. He was the one who was receiving it. God has brought the world to our doorstep in the last two generations. Students and migrants from all over Europe and the world. Remember Lydia and insist on both welcoming people into your home and allowing yourself to be invited into theirs. If you receive an offer of hospitality to eat with your neighbours, take it. I know culturally here it's polite to refuse the first time. Okay? But in their culture, it may only be polite to invite just the once. So, if you're invited, go. You're not being polite by refusing. Often, you can say more by eating someone else's food than inviting them to come and eat yours. So, in conclusion, in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, we read Jesus' words. This command he gave to his disciples that we've already heard this morning. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. Well, contextualizing that challenge to mission for our situation, if Gloucester is our Jerusalem and Britain our Judea, then continental Europe is our Samaria. Unfortunately, it's not only our Samaria because it's our neighbouring region, but also because it tends to elicit the same sort of prejudice and blindness that the Jews had towards the Samaritans. As I visit churches around the UK, I'm frankly shocked by the prejudice that I encounter about mission to Europe. I find churches that are willing to send money to help refugees in Africa, but who treat refugees in this country with the same disdain that you often find in the pages of the Daily Mail. I even know of a missionary family who were engaged in a strategic church planting ministry in the south of France, but who had to leave because their denomination couldn't raise support for them, and they were relocated to somewhere where they could, and they're on the way to Beirut. There they could support them, but they couldn't find the money to support them in the south of France. Why? Because of the prejudice that there is about mission in Europe. We need to ask God to open our eyes to the spiritual realities on our doorstep, to forgive us for our prejudice against our European neighbours, and to help us to heed the call of the man of Macedonia, the man of Madrid, the man of Moldova, the many places around Europe where there are brothers and sisters praying, come over and help us. That's what Pedro and Claire are about to do. So the first thing to do is to remember them in your prayers, but I have a few more challenges. If you felt convicted about anything I've said this morning, then pray for forgiveness. God is a forgiving God. Pray that God would change your attitude towards Europe. If you recognize that you have hardened your heart there, remember the Good Samaritan. Read that when you get home and think about it. Who's the good guy in that story? Maybe I should rewrite it as the parable of the good European. To pray for Europe, to make a point of reading not just the UK news, but also the European news, and taking those things to prayer. To commit yourself to praying for your neighbours here in Gloucester that come from other European countries. And also to pray for those missionaries that we have in Europe, both the gardeners in Romania, Pedro and Claire, during this time, and those who are in this part of Europe, the Thompsons, the Harrisons, and the Rimkai here in Gloucester, who are working with many of those people who've come here from other parts of Europe. So pray for Rita and Vidas. I'd also encourage you this summer, if you travel out to another part of Europe on holiday, to take what I call the Troas Challenge, which is that every time you cross a border, a European border, there's no border posts there anymore. You don't have to show your passport. But the time that you would have used in showing your passport, to use it in prayer for that country, for the church there, for the missionaries that are working there, that the gospel will be preached in that country. I'd like to challenge you too to give. Paradoxically, it's harder to raise money for missionaries who work in Europe than almost anywhere else in the world. And say, well, they've got lots of money. Actually, no. It's a very expensive place to live and to work. And so I'd encourage you to think about your giving too. And also, lastly, to think about how you might respond in respect to your actions. And here I want to mention just two things quickly. First of all, there are lots of short and long-term possibilities. ECM and other missions have opportunities even this summer. So if you're interested in doing something, just speak to Christine or I. But you don't have to go anywhere else other than Gloucester to be able to do mission in Europe, of course. We're in Europe. So remember that challenge about hospitality and think about what you might do this week. As someone once said, you don't become a missionary by buying a plane ticket. You do it by doing mission with people who are like you and live near you.